Today on Athens News Matters, our show focuses on the local impact of COVID-19. Plus, we talk to State Representatives Spencer Fry and Houston Gaines about the state's response to the pandemic.
We did ratify the first ever public health state of emergency. And by doing so, we gave the governor widespread authority in terms of what he would be able to do with state resources.
I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, the virus's impact on the local economy.
When we socially isolate, what we're not thinking about with the big picture here is what's the impact on these households and these individuals in the event that we don't go out and patronize establishments.
Those stories, healthy socialization in the age of social distancing and more, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Before we get to our first segment, we want to tell you that today's program may sound a little different. Out of an abundance of caution, many of our interviews and other stories have been produced remotely. What does that mean for you, the listener? You'll hear more sound from phone calls and Skype instead of studio quality sound, but we know how important it is to provide timely, local, accurate information, and our team of producers has been working mostly remotely to bring you just that. As the federal government implements emergency measures in an effort to slow COVID-19 infection, state and county governments are following suit. Here to discuss our county's local response to the pandemic is Athens-Clarke County Mayor Kelly Gertz. Welcome.
Glad to be with you and your listeners.
Well, first of all, I've just got to say, Mayor, how are you and your family holding up?
Thanks. Thanks much for asking. We are holding up. Fortunately, my sister lives here in town, so my son has been able to spend a little bit of time with her. We actually were on vacation together last week, so you know this is a cluster with whom have we've had continual contact. My wife has been working overtime in her job as a corporate communication director since last Friday, so we're just trying to brew lots of coffee. Some days it feels like we're single-handedly keeping the economy alive just through coffee consumption.
Coffee is our friend in times like this, I know for me at least, and certainly not the way you expected your mayorship to go, having to deal with something like this.
No, I was reflecting with a colleague just the other day that we have had so many great policies that have been rolling out this year, so much community collaboration, so many things getting off the ground, which we're very happy about.
Sure.
And this has put a pause on some of those. But I think the fact that over the last year and change, we've had such a consolidation of interest in some areas means that there already were conversations among people that are now being conversations shifted into this COVID-19 crisis. So I think that the same energy is now going to response to this crisis.
Have there been any conversations between the Athens-Clarke County local government and maybe some of the neighboring counties?
We haven't had conversations about ordinance action. Where regionalism has really come into play is around testing and crisis response.
Sure.
I think some of those corollaries around our ordinance are going to come into conversation. Part of what I think we always do here in Athens is lead the pack, and I think this forward-leaning nature has benefited us locally. I mean, certainly you look at the sort of great state of affairs over the last year, and that's true. And I think that's going to be true here in this time of crisis also.
So go ahead and tell us, if you could, just kind of the basics of what you guys have come up with as far as these ordinances, and give us some highlights. And specifically, I think it's important to outline those folks who may be wondering, what if I'm headed to work?
Absolutely. So travel to and from employment is a specifically permitted activity. I encourage everybody to go to accgov.com and look at the full text of the ordinance and the information available there for more information. I want to let people know that we are not implementing any of these measures lightly. We're doing it for our collective health. One of the things that we learned in the meeting last night through a series of presentations by local healthcare experts is just the fragility of our local system. Already, we were at a deficit of doctors, we're at a deficit of nurses and other support staff, and we know that we've got a local population where 60% of our folks have risk factors, diabetes, age, and the like.
Sure.
So that means that particularly now, we're compelled to act. And what we did is pass a mandatory shelter-in-place ordinance. And it really has sort of two populations that are under examination. The first are individuals. For individuals, if you need to recreate, you should recreate. You should go for a walk, you should go for a jog, you should go for a bike ride, but you should maintain distance from others. What you should not do is get together with 10 of your buddies and go play basketball on the court.
Right.
Now, I also want to be clear about remedies, because a lot of the conversation leading up to this had to do with this prospect of something like a police state or a formal quarantine. This isn't being enforced through arrest. It's not being enforced through anybody ending up in the back of a police car and certainly not in jail. It's being enforced through direction and education.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want that clear to everybody. The second big population under examination are businesses and non-essential businesses, those kind of retail businesses that are not grocery stores or pharmacies or sell essential items. Those non-essential businesses are closed. So your greeting card shops, your lamp shop, place where you go get records.
Right.
And I'm sad that I can't walk into Lux Street, but, getting that new LP is not critical right now. And
right.
So I don't need to be coming into contact with anybody else over there. So those folks are closed. For restaurants, they're offering curbside or carryout or delivery service only.
Perfect. So let me spin to something else. Is our healthcare system well equipped on this?
We, as I alluded to earlier, are not as well equipped as we ideally would be. But right now, we're interacting very regularly as a local government with our two hospitals, with the Northeast Georgia Health District, and with others in the community to make sure we're sharing information. We're talking right now about a government working with some others to set up another testing site. And so that's the kind of thing that we know we can't do alone, that we've got to do in collaboration with others.
I know there's so much we don't know that's heading our way. Many Athens-Clarke County citizens rely on their jobs in the service industry for economic stability. As more businesses close or limit employee hours, how's the mayor and commission planning to offer support to citizens affected by this?
We're going to direct the $3 million of unexpended prosperity package funds that were allocated for this current fiscal year by the commission to support.
Good.
Support for nonprofits, support for individuals, and support for businesses. We've directed the manager to come up with a template of options by no later than next Friday. That $3 million we know will be the tip of the iceberg, but we need to get started now. We also are going to be interacting very strongly with our state and our federal authorities as we're able to draw down those dollars as they're allocated.
How about Athens Transit, and what about school districts distributing meals? What's the latest on stuff like that?
So the school district is continuing to distribute meals on 15 routes. I encourage everybody to go to the Clarke County School District website where you can find that information. They're delivering thousands of meals a day. They're doing yeoman's work with lots of volunteers. I want to give enormous credit to Fenwick Broyard and everybody over at the school district who's helping to keep that program in place. And that's going to continue for as long as students are out of school. Yeah, I apologize, Chris. What was the other part of your question?
Athens Transit, how are the buses operating?
So through the emergency period, the buses are running fare-free. People are entering and exiting through the rear of the bus, so they don't have to get close to the driver. They don't have to touch the pay kiosk on each one of the buses. But those are continuing to run on the same schedule that buses would normally run on what is UGA's spring break schedule. So it's that slightly reduced service. But we know that many people rely on Athens Transit to get to work, to get to medical providers, and to get to the grocery store.
Well, one other thing is, I think in terms of what people are going through and how they're struggling, and folks are really starting to worry about income problems. And have you guys considered any response to a potential spike in eviction notices as some individuals struggle to make rent?
We've thought a lot about that. Obviously, we're in the early days of this crisis, but we needed to act fast. I'll give a lot of praise to Judge Barron and her fellow magistrate court judges. They have put any eviction hearings on hold through mid-April, and we will see if that's extended,
great.
Just as we'll see what other supports are extended.
Well, obviously, this situation is constantly changing. How can we as Athens residents best prepare for changes in local government operations? And then how can we help? Or I know we're trying to stay away from each other, but are there specific things we could do to help?
Absolutely, there are. I would say, first, reach out to friends and loved ones. You know, I, for the first time in my life, have been using FaceTime to interact with people, not my family, this week, just to see some other friendly faces.
Yeah.
I think keeping your mental health in check is important right now.
Yeah.
And so I encourage everybody to do that. If you like to jog, do go out for that jog, staying distant from others. Please keep up with local government activity. We do have a landing page. It's accgov.com/coronavirus that provides full local information. And please, to the extent possible, support your local businesses. For them, every dollar matters right now. So that food carry out, you know, if you do have to get supplies of any sort, look for a local vendor who provides those supplies so those dollars stay here in Athens.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Kelly Gertz is the mayor of Athens, Clark County, Georgia. Mayor Gertz, again, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us and our listeners today.
Glad to be with you. Be well, Chris.
You too.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
I'm Michael Lahusky at the Georgia Museum of Art. We're an underwriter at WUGA. Having our announcements on WUGA gives us an opportunity to direct people to our website, freeinspiration.art, where they can find out more about our exhibitions and our many programs. We feel it's a great way to get our message out to all of Athens, all of its citizens, and all of Georgia. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Our program today is focused on COVID-19 and the local and state reaction to this very fluid situation. Earlier this week, I spoke separately with two Georgia state representatives. We'll hear from Republican Houston Gaines in a few minutes. But first, my conversation with his Democratic colleague, Spencer Fry of Athens, who joined me from his back porch. So thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you give our listeners an update on this ever-changing situation?
Yes, I can. This is definitely an ever-changing situation, but the things that I will tell you right now are not changing until this is over. And so it's extremely important for the listeners to understand, speaking to healthcare workers that are on the front lines. These are actual doctors, emergency room doctors, that are telling me the things that we need to do as a community, as a state and nation, to stop the spread of this very serious and deadly disease. The first is, if you're awake, wash your hands at least once an hour. Number two, this is very serious. People need to understand that you need to practice extreme social distancing. And what that means is, unless you have to go out or be around somebody, don't do it. And then the third thing, this is extremely important. You know, our healthcare systems have a certain capacity, and we have currently in place, there are very rigid testing criteria. And so if you feel any symptoms such as fatigue, body aches, cough, diarrhea, or fever, immediately isolate yourself and call your doctor. Do not go to the hospital to try to get tested. And we're working on getting testing facilities set up within the state.
So, Spencer, in terms of the state response, what seems to be working and what needs improvement?
So with the state's response so far, we were able to, you know, the crossover day, we were able to appropriate $100 million extra dollars from the rainy day fund for the governor to utilize to fight the spread of the virus. That weekend, the governor called for a special session to ratify a declaration of a public health state of emergency, which has never been done in the history of the state. And so legislators were asked to come back Monday morning. We voted, we granted the governor's powers. He has emergency powers for 30 days. Now, this is extremely important because I want everybody to understand that never before has this public health state of emergency been called in the state. Never before has session been suspended with no end in sight, meaning that we don't know when we're going to go back and complete our constitutionally required jobs for this year. And that's a big deal. And your legislators are taking this very seriously. And it's not the time to panic. The time is to be smart. And the time is to pay attention to what the doctors are saying. And it's extremely important that we do that. We believe that we are grossly underreported here in Athens-Clarke County. We feel like that there are a lot of patients that have been released from the hospitals here and not tested that are symptomatic, and they have just been asked to self-quarantine. We don't even know if that's been happening or not. We don't have the infrastructure in place to monitor all those people we send home. Right now, I cannot stress enough that the social distancing is the most important thing that we can be doing right now as a community.
Spencer, you mentioned this briefly, but obviously, you know, these are unusual circumstances, and legislators did vote to give the governor power during the crisis. So what can he do unilaterally, and what can't he do?
The governor will have the authority to seize property, to remove people from being in charge of a hospital and place new people in charge of being in a hospital. There's a broad expansion of powers for a limited time that the governor gets in a public health state of emergency. So a lot of power in that. A lot of trust has gone into this governor in order to help us through this crisis. One thing that I wish the governor would do is that several other states have taken the steps to mandatorily close businesses. And I know that's going to hurt, but it'd be better to close now for a couple of weeks than to have to close later because the whole community is sick.
Spencer, thank you for your time.
Oh, you bet. Alexia, you holler at me. Text me whenever you got a question and I'll be there for you.
Spencer Fry is an Athens Democrat and state representative for District 118. Also this week, I spoke with Fry's Republican colleague, Representative Houston Gaines, who represents parts of Athens-Clarke, Barrow, Jackson, and Oconee counties. Here's our conversation. So, Houston, we're discussing the state's response to the coronavirus outbreak. And first, what do you think is working and what do you think needs improvement?
Certainly the improvement that we're all working towards is increased testing. Right now, our testing capacity is not where it needs to be. Folks who are being hospitalized are largely the only ones that are being tested. But, you know, the public health department is increasing testing capacity by the day. Our local hospitals are as well. We continue to be in touch. We had a long meeting this past weekend with both local hospitals along with other healthcare providers in the area. So we're working to increase testing. You know, the other area where we are going to have to increase capacity is materials that the healthcare workers need on the front lines. In terms of, you know, what we're doing very well, I think the state is doing a very good job of communicating to the public where we are and what needs we have. You know, on Monday, we declared for the first time in state history a public health state of emergency.
Legislators have voted to give the governor more powers. What can he do on his own, and what can't he do?
Well, first off, the governor, Governor Kemp, I just want to commend him for the work that he's been doing as we've all dealt with this. He has been just so forthcoming with information. Certainly, it's not easy, but he and his team have been working around the clock to not only keep elected officials up to date, but the public up to date. And we've seen that because I think information flow is one of the most important things during this time, is making sure people know exactly what's going on and what we as people in the public need to be doing. But as you said, we did ratify the first ever public health state of emergency. And by doing so, we gave the governor widespread authority in terms of what he would be able to do with state resources, with civil helpers, with the budget. It does allow the governor, with the Revenue Shortfall Reserve Fund, which is $2.8 billion, should there be a necessity to use further funding, we did allocate $100 million in the amended budget. And the governor has told us that should he require more funding, he would be in touch. But it also allows, you know, should we get to the point of quarantining, it would allow that. It allows the governor to suspend rules and regulations, and whether that's for 18-wheeler trucks to be able to drive longer hours if they deem it necessary, so they can deliver groceries, deliver supplies, whether that's cutting the regulations for doctors and nurses in other states that are not licensed here but are in good standing with their home state, allowing them to come into Georgia and practice. So it does allow, like I say, widespread authority for the governor to help us deal with this crisis. And the actions that he would take certainly all relate to fighting COVID-19. And so it was a necessary step. Again, it's the first time in our state's history we've ever done this. So certainly it's a historic time and something that we felt was necessary. And, you know, bipartisan, everybody agreed on it.
Is there any sort of economic relief for working Georgians, especially in sectors like the service industry, available?
Right now, the relief that we're going to see for individuals is going to come from the federal government. And so I know that the president and the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House are working jointly to find relief for individuals, for small businesses, because small businesses are just being hammered right now. Individuals are you know, particularly hourly employees, are you know, not being able to work. I mean, this is a real challenge. And so certainly I call on our federal government to do all it can to support individuals because we've got to continue to find ways to help people. I mean, whether it's finding that personal relief or for businesses or for the economy in general. I mean, the economy in general certainly is taking a big hit. And so this is certainly just, you know, when you look back, we've never seen anything necessarily like this before. And so, you know, as the government's asking people basically to stay home, you know, this is one of those times where it's going to take the government stepping up and helping individuals that need relief.
Thank you so much, Houston. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
My name is Morgan Fry, and I am a recently graduated master's student in journalism at Grady College. The project that I'm most proud to have contributed to while at WGA is definitely the StoryCorps Athens project. I feel really honored to be one of the few people who has listened in entirety to these StoryCorps stories, and it really helps me feel more connected to Athens. Learn more about WUGA internships at wuga.org.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Social distancing is the buzzword of the day, with local leaders like District 7 Commissioner Russell Edwards encouraging citizens to stay at home and avoid public places to halt the spread of the coronavirus.
Leaders around the globe and in this nation are working the hardest they possibly can to decisively act on the front end of this crisis. So really, step one, we've got to act decisively to help arrest the spread to save lives.
But if everyone is avoiding restaurants, movie theaters, and bars, what happens to the people who staff those establishments? These hourly workers make up a large segment of Athens' economy. And Dr. Michael Thomas, professor of personal finance at UGA and co-host of the podcast Nothing Funny About Money, worries about how these workers will fare economically if social distancing continues.
For a lot of our service industry, unfortunately, who are getting paid on a weekly or a biweekly basis, depending on our setup, they have to start to worry about these things. And then when we socially isolate, what we're not thinking about with the big picture here is what's the impact on these households and these individuals in the event that we don't go out and patronize establishments.
Dr. Matt Gorin, Dr. Thomas's co-host on Nothing Funny About Money and professor of personal finance at the American College of Financial Services, says that the economic downturn may even increase service workers' health risk.
The people who depend on the hourly pay, them not having any income or depleting what savings they have, has real consequences for their health. We know that financial stress has higher incidence of heart attack, of stroke.
Compromised immune system.
Right. So those people are going to get sick, and many of them will perish.
Commissioner Edwards assures that the mayor and commission are making plans to aid workers who are economically affected by the virus. But he emphasizes that stopping the virus should be citizens' number one priority.
The mayor and commission is discussing various relief packages. You know, we have $3 million set aside for the prosperity package. We have money in the government, okay? So I just want folks to be sure that step one, stop the virus to save lives. Step two, help out folks who were harmed by the stopping the virus.
Thomas and Gorin don't disagree with this strategy. However, Gorin says that the social distancing and quarantine measures will shift which communities are most affected by the virus.
The people who can handle a downturn the best are salaried folks.
Yep.
Those people tend to be older. They tend to be in the middle class or upper class. They tend to be whiter. So we are going to reduce the risk of mortality to the coronavirus, but we're shifting that risk to other people who are younger. They're more likely to be poor. They're more likely to be a person of color.
So how can we support the service industry while keeping ourselves and others safe? Thomas uses his family's Friday night pizza run as an example of how to properly patronize a local business without risking exposure to the virus.
We get some wipes and we just wipe down the doors coming in and then coming out. We don't touch anything. We opt not to get a receipt from our purchase and we use a credit card. We're not exchanging with cash. We literally have gone through this entire process and have not actually exposed ourselves or really anyone else. But we've also been able to ensure that someone who is counting on being called in that evening is going to be in a financially viable situation.
Ultimately, Thomas and Gorin say that our greatest asset is each other, and that while keeping safe is a priority, we should consider how to keep our service industry and those in it safe as well.
I don't think either of us is suggesting that every single person go out and potentially expose themselves to this. If you have symptoms, don't go out, stay at home. But for the rest of us, let's try to find those ways to remain active in the business world in our community so that we don't expose so many people to layoffs and financial stress.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Alexia Ridley.
With many of Athens' vulnerable populations expecting a big financial hit from COVID-19's effects, some locals are taking the extra step to inform their neighbors on the extent of resources within the Athens community. WUGA's Sophie Gratis reports.
Left in the wake of business closures and social distancing are some of our most vulnerable citizens. those in the service industry. For the purpose of this story, I'm referring to people whose livelihoods depend on a robust and social community. Artists, musicians, local businesses, and their employees. You get the gist. The vulnerability of our service industry in the face of COVID-19 has encouraged immense community outreach. Although most help is coming from behind a computer screen, this virtual philanthropy is filling in gaps left by a slow-moving federal and state government.
Just to be clear, all of these interviews were conducted over Skype, so the audio isn't great, but hopefully you guys will get the idea.
We have to use the resources that we've kind of built up from the ground.
That's Alden DiCamillo, a local artist and activist who spoke with me about the Athens Mutual Aid Network. This network, run by a team of Athens residents, launched its website on March 15th, creating a comprehensive and organized platform for local resources responding to COVID-19's effects on the community. DiCamillo has been in charge of website design and research, using the site previously occupied by their small business. No one on this team is being paid or was contracted. Here's DiCamillo again.
So many of the resources on the website are people that have been doing activist work in Athens for so long. You know, there's a lot of despair. There's a lot of weird stats. And I think it's okay to feel sad, but I think it's really also okay to lean really, really hard into this activist work and stay in your social distance bubble, but also really support your fellow man.
On this website DiCamillo was referring to, the Athens Mutual Aid Network homepage, resources are separated under categories. Examples include health and wellness, financial support, education and internet access, and food access. There are also links to volunteer and donation opportunities.
What our role is to network. You know, so if somebody has an organization, they're already doing 16,000 things. But what I know I can do is I can build a website and I can gather information in a way where it's visual and also readable. You know, there's a lot of criticism for technology, as there should be. But right now, I think humans are really coming together in ways that are amazing. I think it points to the resilience and the flexibility of generations.
According to 2019 estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau, 59.6% of the Athens-Clarke County population, 16 years and older, work in the civilian labor force.
So most commonly, these jobs include managerial positions, teachers, retail and food sales, and truck drivers. On March 18th, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp and representatives from the Georgia Department of Labor publicly acknowledged a spike in partial unemployment claims filed both by employers and employees of suffering businesses across the state. It's become clear, however, that response to these types of claims are slow compared to initiatives launched by community members.
My name is Maggie Songster. I'm a born and raised townie in Athens. Currently, I work as a sustainability associate at the Athens Office of Sustainability.
Working remotely, Songster isn't suffering from unemployment. But with the extra time she's had, Songster was one of the first to offer a publicly available online document with hundreds of resources for people struggling against the COVID-19 pandemic. Her document carries similar resources as the Athens Mutual Aid Network, but it does offer a wider scope of links that go beyond just local. This document has also been translated into Spanish.
What I specialize in is organizing information, doing research on the side. So if I see something and I look through and I read it and it seems legitimate, I throw it up on the document. I try and make it as organized as possible to make sure that when they're looking for something, they can find exactly what it is that they need. I wanted to get organized. I didn't want to see a resource and let it like fly by me. And I've been really surprised with how many people are like, oh, this is exactly what I need.
With the ever-changing landscape of this pandemic, it's impossible to know exactly what measures will be taken to tackle its effects. But for now, keep an eye out on social media feeds. You really never know what neighbor is going to have your back next. Recording at home, but for Athens News Matters nonetheless, I'm Sophie Gratis.
According to a release from U.S. health officials on Monday, the first human trials for a coronavirus vaccine began on March 16th in Seattle, Washington. While still in the very early stages, the world is racing to find answers as to how long a vaccine could take. Here to help us shed light on this process is Dr. Scott Pagan and Dr. Grace Gowda, Dr. Pagan is associate professor in pharmaceutical and biomedical sciences here at UGA, also director of the UGA Drug Discovery Center and chair of the College of Pharmacy COVID-19 Working Group. And Dr. Grace Gowda is director of the International Biomedical Regulatory Sciences Program for the College of Pharmacy. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So could you walk us through the process of introducing a vaccine? We'll start with you, Dr. Pagan.
Sure. So there's a lot of basic science at the front end that just has to happen, just the early stages of finding the right platform to utilize. And then we have to go into kind of some of the other considerations of the basic science realm, which is how long are you protected for from the virus? So just because you get vaccinated, does that vaccination last for a couple of weeks? Does it last for a couple of months? And that kind of is some of the studies that add to the time frame that you look at when you try to bring a vaccine to market. Once you get into that, a lot of the vaccines that you're seeing coming out now, one of the benefits is that a lot of this stuff was developed for the original severe acute respiratory syndrome virus. The current virus that's out there, now called SARS-CoV-2, is about 80% similar to that virus that was in 2003. So we have a lot of that basic science knowledge worked out, and that's why you're seeing some of these vaccine candidates reaching the clinical trials so quickly. Kind of from there, I'll kind of hand it off to Grace because she'll probably have a little more information on, you know, what those phase 1, 2, and 3 trials are probably going to look like.
So once we finish the phase 1, then as Dr. Pagan said, we need to know what is the dose, how many times do we have to give, how long, what is the duration of immunity. So those will be the phase 2 trials. Once phase 2 is done, then we go through the phase 3 trials, which is the bigger population. The phase 3 kind of confirms the hypothesis that the vaccine is working in all kinds of populations.
During these clinical trials, what are scientists and researchers looking for as far as the response? I mean, does this have to be a perfect vaccine? In other words, we have to see complete immunity. And how do you even gauge that? Is there a timeline where you expose someone to the virus and then wait a certain amount of time to see for sure that they aren't going to come down with the virus? I mean, how does all that work?
So that is a very good question. In our case here in COVID-19, we are in an emergency use situation. So the agency has all kinds of ways that they could find the answer. The experts will decide on the study design along with FDA to make sure that they test the right type of population. Again, we are trying to crunch the amount of time from 10 years, for example, into 1 year, maybe 18 months.
Yeah, if I could chime in for a second. Yeah, I mean, I think
absolutely.
As Grace is saying, you know, the public here is a year and a year and a half. You know, we want to make sure they understand that it's not that there's a stack of paper sitting on somebody's desk. A lot of these studies literally take 30, 60 days to find out whether they're safe, whether they're effective. And then after that, we also have to consider the manufacturing component and how we ramp that up. Once it gets through the clinical trials, then it comes into, well, how do we give that to 250 million Americans or more? That's also going to take some time. So when we're talking about a year, year and a half, as Grace pointed out, I mean, usually we do this in a 10-year time frame. And we're, you know, the scientists around the world and the government officials are all working hand in hand to try to compress that as much as possible. But there's just some areas that you just really can't cut corners on.
We'll make that the last word. That's Dr. Scott Pagan, associate professor in pharmaceutical and biomedical sciences here at the University of Georgia. And we also heard from Dr. Grace Gowda, director of International Biomedical Regulatory Sciences Program for the College of Pharmacy. Thank the two of you so much for taking time out with us.
Thank you for having us.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough
sky.
Moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. As the spread of COVID-19 expands, social distancing is more important now than it ever was before in flattening the curve. But how can parents make sure their kids are social distancing in healthy ways? Janet Frick, an associate professor for the Department of Psychology, speaks with us about what things to keep in mind during these isolated times. Thank you so much for taking a few moments with us.
Thank you for having me.
As we move into self-isolation and overall socially distancing ourselves, this means a lot of our socialization and interacting is moving online. Now, some have said that online interaction, which has been going on for years, especially in millennial and Gen Z culture, is less meaningful than interacting in person. Is there anything to that? Or are online interactions about the same as face-to-face interactions?
That is a great question. And I think one thing that can be helpful to keep in mind is that long distance communication and relating has been part of our culture and our society for quite a long time. One thing to realize is that every mode of interaction is different, but you can have meaningful relationship building over different sorts of virtual mediums. So I think that we shouldn't be afraid of that per se, or think that online communication is going to be problematic, but it's really more a matter of thinking about what are the best practices and the best ways to build on continuing meaningful interaction, especially for our kids who may feel this social isolation a little bit more potently than we adults do.
Some of the culture online can seem a bit toxic, such as online gaming culture. Should parents be wary?
We can't simply say that, you know, online gaming is good or bad, or online interaction is good or bad. So much depends on the culture or the context in which that's taking place. And so there certainly can be toxic aspects of online culture that parents should be aware of. And I think as much as possible, it's helpful to keep lines of communication open for kids to be able to share what they're experiencing, and for there to be, not an over-reliance that kids are only having opportunity to interact with their peers through things like, you know, video games that are connecting them to people who they don't know personally. As an example, I have a friend who said that her middle school child was doing a FaceTime baking session with a friend every day, where they were each in their own kitchen, but they were talking to each other about what they were baking and connecting one-on-one via FaceTime. Now, that's just one example, but having a variety of different ways of connecting with peers would probably be preferable than just having one sort of, type of game, for example.
Well, how will this social distancing and reliance on internet interaction impact the development of interpersonal skills?
That's a great thing to think about, and so much depends on the age of the child. I think for young children, say before, you know, preschool age and under, they don't need peer interaction as much as maybe school age and teenage children do. They just need opportunities to play outside and to explore art and physicality. And they, of course, enjoy having people to play with, but they don't maybe need it quite as much. For school age and teenage kids, those peer relationships are really important developmentally. And I think it's important for parents to acknowledge that and to really realize that building in time for meaningful connection in whatever way their kids are able to is an important developmental need that should be attended to as much as academics and other sorts of things like that. But, you know, we really are in an unprecedented time in terms of the limitations that really need to be followed for public health. So I think it's as kids are old enough to understand why social isolation is so important, it's important for parents and adults to explain the rationale and explain, you know, for example, that asymptomatic people can still spread the virus, and so that this really is something that we all have to be in collectively together.
What are the long-term ramifications this social distancing could have on the development of kids in elementary or middle school?
I think if this is a matter of a few weeks, a couple of months, kids will be fine socially. They will adapt and they will, hopefully have opportunities to explore creative outlets and other, ways of continuing to learn and be engaged. If this goes on for several months, it may present some challenges, especially for kids who maybe were already a little bit more socially isolated themselves. And parents, I think, should spend time thinking about how they can have outlets for connection for their kids, even if it's just something like talking on the phone to a friend, having FaceTime or some other way of being able to communicate. As weeks turn into months, this will be something we really need to think about.
What can parents do to facilitate home environments that are conducive to positive growth in their child or preteen that will offset any negative ramifications of social distancing?
I think that as much as possible, thinking about having a rhythm and a structure to daily activity where, we're engaging different parts of our physical and mental health, having a time where everybody gets off of screens and reads or colors or plays board games, etc., will be important. Think of developing a new hobby, learning to cook, learning an instrument, learning a foreign language. Engaging our minds in various ways will be important.
Well, Professor Janet Frick, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome, and best wishes to everyone for health and sanity during this difficult time.
Thank you. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Martin Matheny is our senior producer, and Gemma DiCarlo is our associate producer. Our segment producers are Jessica Wurst, Megan Wan, and Sophie Gratis. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
And we want to hear from you. We know you've got coronavirus questions. You can email them to us for next week's show, and we'll find the experts to answer them. Just send your question to wuga@uga.edu. And be sure to put Athens News Matters in the subject line. Don't forget, you can hear all of the segments from this week's show and our past shows online at wuga.org, as well as on the WUGA app, which is available for Apple and Android wherever you get your apps. And of course, you can get in touch with WUGA on social media. We're at WUGA FM on Facebook and Twitter. We'd love to hear your story ideas. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Keep your hands washed, your socialization distant, and stay healthy.